Welcome to Bijou Banter, produced by the Bijou Film Board. Since 1972, Bijou has been bringing provocative and engaging cinema to Iowa City. But this week, we're on the road, and we are watching provocative and engaging cinema in Columbia, Missouri. And we're at the True False Film Festival. I'm here. My name is Leah Vonderhyde with my co-host Spencer Williams. Welcome, Spencer.
Hi.
We've been watching documentary films for the last day and a half, and we thought that we'd do a few quick segments to recap some of the cool movies that we have been watching. So we're going to do three films in this kind of mini episode. The first is going to be Casting Jean-Benet. That's directed by Kitty Green. The second one is going to be The Cage Fighter, directed by Jeff Unay. And then finally, the third one, a film we just finished watching tonight, Whose Streets by, oh, help me with this pronunciation, Sabah Foulayan? Foulayan?
Sounds good.
Okay, that's what we're going to go with. And it is, it's early in the morning hours of Sunday, March 5th. So we've been up for a long time watching these movies. Bear with us. Okay, so Spencer, I said I was going to start with Casting Jean-Benet. It's directed by the Australian director Kitty Green. It's a really unusual storytelling of the Jean-Benet, the murder of Jean-Benet, and in some ways is reflecting on how the community around Boulder, Colorado is still processing this murder 20 years later. Yet this is one of the more unusual documentaries we've ever seen. Essentially, it's a series of interviews with actors who are being cast to play the various Ramsey family members and certain town members that were swept up in the murder and the investigation that followed. And how they feel about being cast in that role and how they feel then about those actual people and how they feel about the actual case and how they feel about the actual murder and how they feel about pageantry is one of the things, of course, that they talk about because Jean-Benet was really involved in pageants. And Spencer, I know that that's one of the things that you were interested in going in to watch this film. Did watching this film scratch that itch? Were you able to get enough kind of pageant info along with everything else that was going on in the film?
Well, yes. I mean, the itch is never, ever going to be fully scratched just because there's no way we'll ever know what happened to her. And that's always, like, a frustrating aspect of this case is that, like, as much as anyone wants closure, there's just, like, never going to be closure. And that's sort of touched upon in the film, but I loved the film because I thought it was so, I mean, so often in like your traditional depictions of like televised true crime, like JonBenet Ramsey shows that have been around since the murder basically in the 90s, there's been like a plethora of different sort of like TV show miniseries, like faux TV documentaries that have sort of like, it's become sort of its own canon of like JonBenet Ramsey fodder. But this one takes an interesting perspective in that it's not so much focused on the case files as like on this, like there's no like omnipresent voiceover of like on this fateful day was the day John, like a murder that shocked the nation. You know, it's not like one of those where we basically already know what's going to be said and we can sort of, there's no conclusion other than the one that we've been given time and time again. And in this film, it's sort of similar to that, only the way that it's presented is almost, I don't know, it's almost like a pageant in and of itself of like the pageantry of audition. It's sort of like,
yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it.
Yeah, like, it's just a bunch of people auditioning for the roles, I guess, of the players in the JonBenet Ramsey case. But it's also, like, they're auditioning for basically, like a faux show or, like, a faux movie of, like, it's not a real, tangible, like, I guess, film that they're auditioning for. They're essentially auditioning as the documentary. Like, the documentary is, like, their audition for these people. It's really hard to explain how, actually, it's, like, set up. But, yeah, it's, like, there's sort of this pageantry of, like, these different people coming at the roles, like, of JonBenet Ramsey's mother or father. It's sort of, like, each person comes at the character, the person, from a different angle based solely on sort of knowledge and, like, conspiracy that they've sort of had to deal with, being people that have lived in that community where that murder happened, and sort of, like, dealing with the trauma of that sort of lingering over their entire adult lives, it seems, while also wrestling with their own traumas and sort of how they kind of use those personal traumas to, I guess, find a way to connect to the JonBenet Ramsey case in some way to, I don't know, get a more realistic performance, or, like, just better to find a new ways of understanding the people in the case, even though it seems like an impossible task.
Yeah, because a lot of these actors are amateur actors, and so the way that they're going about connecting with the character is very, very much based on their understanding of certain events that have happened in their own lives. Like, they're not using some other acting technique to get to the truth. A lot of their acting technique seems really grounded in their own experience with loss or their own experience with the law and kind of so on and so forth. One of the things that this film made me think of is The Thin Blue Line, which, when that came out in the 80s, wasn't even classified as a documentary because of its use of reenactment. And I guess one of the, you know, and now the way in which that film used reenactment is become almost standard for a lot of documentaries. But it's almost as if you're watching, like, if The Thin Blue Line, in putting together its reenactments, then interviewed all of the actors playing the reenactment parts, and then you just watched a movie of those people, is essentially what this movie's like. And I do think that there's going to be a similar reaction to this movie where some people are going to think that this essentially doesn't qualify as a documentary because it's so unusual. And I think it absolutely is a documentary. But I do think that there's going to be lots of conversations about that and about the ways in which this film is kind of pushing documentary into new areas. And I'm sure we're going to see some of these techniques, like, pop up in other films moving forward.
It definitely feels like it feels like a movie, like a feature film version of, like, the special features, like, of How We Made This on just, like, your normal fiction DVD, where you have sort of the actors talking about their process and sort of you see sort of the sets that they worked on as sets and not just, like, what they appear to be, like, in the actual film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like it's a making of, but there's no actual of
product that they're making other than what we're seeing, I guess, on the screen in front of us. And I don't know, I guess I have sort of, I'm curious to know what you thought of sort of the editing tactics in this movie. I remember in the Q&A, the director, Kitty Green, said she wanted to sort of find a balance between funny and, like, just, like, the incredible dark material that is the JonBenet Ramsey case, and sort of not wanting to drown the audience in sort of the more morose and grotesque details of the case by inserting sort of these, like, moments of humor. But there were a lot of times in the film where I found myself laughing only to feel immediately guilty of the fact that I'm laughing at sort of reenactments of, or, like, people's approach to reenactments of, like, a very grisly unsolved murder of a very young girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that was, like, an intentional sort of discomfort that I was feeling on the director's part of sort of, like, sort of splicing together these, like, absurd moments of humor, particularly with child actors, or even with adult actors saying sort of ridiculous things, or seemingly ridiculous things, only then to sort of come at you with like a very deep, sort of like very personal detail that sort of ties into why they said that ridiculous thing. And so you're laughing at the ridiculous thing until they say the other thing. And then you're like, oh, I shouldn't have laughed at that. And it's sort of like, I don't know what the film is or I didn't know what the film was trying to do with the audience specifically in those moments. And I was wondering if you felt particularly, like, similarly sort of uncomfortable, or you sort of like, if you felt yourself, like you felt the experience of laughing at something in the film only to then have to sort of like reflect back on yourself as a viewer,
mm-hmm.
and sort of have to like sort of mule over why ultimately we are laughing at sort of the pain and the process of trying to unpack an unsolved murder that has stumped everyone since it happened in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's highly manipulative, and there's a lot of, like, legitimately laugh-out-loud moments, and I think the director, I don't think the director is, like, completely innocent in some sort of, like, ethical righteousness in doing this, but she does make us so complicit as viewers that we're all kind of just stuck in the same boat either way.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't feel like I have any grounds to judge her, because I think there's a certain, the point of the humor is because ultimately this is about being fascinated with a case, right? Like, we shouldn't forget that there's a murder of an innocent child at the center of it, but at the same time, that's not why, like, we keep coming back to it because of our own really morbid fascination with all of the details surrounding it. And so this movie really makes that clear. Like, we are really fascinated by the circus that surrounds it. And sometimes that does make us laugh. And I don't think we can, like, blame the filmmaker for that, even though
right.
that's clearly her intention. Like, she wants to tease that out
yeah,
of us.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, she definitely seemed in the Q&A to be very aware of that. Like,
yeah.
this case is bonkers. We can't stop talking about it. So this is, you know, here's the film I made.
Right.
yeah. All right, well, we should wrap up there on casting JonBenet. That is actually going to be distributed via Netflix, I believe, towards the end of April.
28th, I think, is what she said.
I feel like it's April 28th as well.
One of the producers
said,
yeah.
I will agree with that. So, and I think a lot of people are going to talk about it during that week when it comes out. It's the kind
yeah.
of film that's going to create a lot of buzz. All right, so moving on, The Cage Fighter is a film that we saw today by Jeff Unay. We also got to see the whole family that was kind of at the center of it. The Cage Fighter is about Joe Carmen, who participates in mixed martial arts and competes. And it's kind of tearing his family apart because he's getting injured. He's suffering multiple concussions. His daughters don't want him to do it anymore. His wife doesn't want him to do it anymore. And yet he feels like compelled to do it to sort of validate himself. I think he might even use that term himself. I feel like, Spencer, you have a lot you want to talk about with this movie. So I'm
like,
going to give it
to
you.
I've been honestly thinking about this film all day and sort of like, and I'm not, like, normally when people say, oh, I've been thinking about this film all day, usually is a sign that, oh, like, the film is operating on a level that is, like, interesting and is, like, it's usually a sign that maybe it's a good film that we're watching. But I actually have a lot of problems with this film, which is why I'm thinking about it so much. And, like, every time I think about it, there's something else that I just find, like, I don't, like, this film seems so, I'm so, like, so ethically, like, wrong or something about, I don't know, I don't, like, that's such a strong sentiment, but, like, there's something about, I guess, the direction of the film and sort of the way that it unfolds that feels a little exploitative to me, in the sense of, like, okay, the director is filming this cage fighter who is keeping the secret, pretty badly keeping the secret from his family. And so then the director is sort of complicit in this lie that is ultimately, like, ruining this family that's already seems to be walking on a very, like, thin rope. Because, I mean, the mother has an illness. There's four daughters. There's, like, a custody sort of situation that also is complicated and messy. And then also you have the main protagonist who is sort of like, who fights, it seems, just for the thrill of the fight. I mean, he's not making any money off of these fights, which is stated. And it's like the only reason he's doing these fights is seemingly for like a self-worth kind of thing. But in that kind of self-worth, there's sort of like, it's costing his family. It's really, like, causing, like, an emotional toll on, like, every single member of the family that at a certain point his, like, obsession with fighting almost seems selfish. And the film frames it in such a way that at the end it feels sort of like a redemption story without the redemption in it. Like, he doesn't really do anything to warrant my sympathy, and like, in the sense of, like, I mean, like, it's his fault essentially that his family unit seems to be falling apart, in the sense that he has a job and he's making money from that job, and it's not fighting, and yet it's the fighting that is sort of causing all of these tensions in the family and, like, the emotional burdens, I guess, of, like, very young daughters who are frightened that their dad is gonna die or gonna be, like, severely injured. Like, very justified sort of fears. And he so flippantly sort of casts them off as, like, oh, but, like, I need to do this. But the film never really delves into why that need is there. And I was more curious to sort of... It, like, the film, I felt, wanted to be this character study, but it never went deep enough for me to understand why it was necessary to film this family, or to, like, I don't know. And, like, the director at the Q&A, too, I mean, he basically said that he made this movie to battle writer's block, and so there's not really, like, an emotional attachment to the people in this film as much as, like, he could have stumbled upon any subject for his next film, it seems, and, like, this was just the one that came on, fell on his lap, you know? And it seems like, I don't know, it seems for him, or it felt like a fun exercise or something, but, I mean, there's, like, like, the wife is totally shorthanded in this, like, just, like, completely underserved in this film. The daughters are sort of underserved in this film. I mean, it's edited in such a way that we feel the pain of the daughters, and yet somehow at the end, it's, like, it's supposed to make you, I mean, it wants to make you feel good, but there's something about the relationships that happened prior that don't lead the viewer into that, like, seamlessly or, like, smoothly. Like, I didn't... when everyone seems happy in the end, I felt like it couldn't possibly be true.
Yeah, the resolution at the end didn't seem earned in terms of the way that the film was put together.
Right.
I think I generally agree with everything you're saying. There's some ethical issues that even during the Q&A with the director and the family didn't fully get answered for me about entering into this whole situation initially, in being complicit in helping this man deceive his family, even after he had met the family. I mean, shortly after it becomes clear, you know, the cards are kind of put on the table, but it's still an ethically problematic way to get involved in a film. I agree that it just was essentially not made that well. Like, if you think about the craft of documentary filmmaking, I don't think that the resolution was really earned in terms of what we saw. Because we didn't actually, I thought when I found out it was going to be the cage fighter, because initially this was a secret screening, but when I heard it was the cage fighter, I thought it was going to be a film that was going to look at maybe class relationships that kind of surround the MMA fighting circuit and the ways in which people get kind of drawn into that kind of ultimate fighting. And I don't know that it needed that another film needs to be made that explores that, or another TV show needs to be made that explores that world. But if this was going to be a character study, which I think it was trying to be, it kind of fell flat on that level as well, because we just don't understand the arc that he's the character arc is just a little bit too forced. There's a lot of like essentially Rocky allusions and these like old school boxing movie tropes of running through the streets at dawn and, you know, just like, what is it, fighting going all the way, or fighting all the way? What does Rocky yell at the end of that first movie? I went to the end. I don't know, I apologize, but it started to feel like it was clinging to tropes as opposed to fully exploring the world of this man and his family. I will say, I actually thought that Callie, the daughter, had really awesome scenes. In fact, the daughters might have been underserved, but I actually felt like a lot of they were such real people to me.
Yeah.
That I enjoyed that. Like the youngest daughter, and there's essentially a comic, but also totally, it becomes a metaphor for the entire movie, but scene with the youngest daughter in the hose, which I enjoyed. And then a really strong scene with Joe's father, where they're confronting each other. And I felt like that was perhaps the strongest scene in the movie, but the movie, I think, essentially just needed more of that exploration.
Yeah, and there's something interesting about the father-son sequence in that there's no resolution to it either, which is like which makes it all the more heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's also, we get a glimpse to see sort of like why, I mean, our protagonist is sort of maybe seeking this validation is because he doesn't get it from his family. I mean, his father's very aggressive and combative and seems to have a very like strict idea of how a father-son relationship should work, that his son isn't subscribing to. And that irks him so much that he's not even willing to have, like, a dialogue about it. And there's, like, some sort of, like, generational masculinity that's, like, not meshing well, I guess, between them. And also, there's, like, another scene that I thought was interesting, but it felt completely out of nowhere, where our protagonist is sort of speaking with another fighter who like kicked his ass earlier in the film, and they're just like at a bar talking sort of about what they've essentially lost because of their occupation or of their hobby, I guess, and sort of like why they feel such a drive to do it despite the people that they've pushed away, essentially, but it never really goes deep. Like, I wish I had, like, a full, I don't know, I felt like that might have even been a more interesting movie of, like, just the two of them sort of parsing out sort of, like, the intimate sort of details as to why they do what they do, rather than just having it being explained as, like, oh, I just need to do this for, like, self-worth. But, like, why is that the outlet? And, like, why is your self-worth, intrinsically tied to whether or not you can, like, beat another guy up and essentially diminish his own self-worth? So, I don't know. I think there's something interesting there that's never fully explained. And that scene kind of comes out of nowhere, too. It seems, like, kind of tacked on. And that's also never really resolved. I was wondering if they, like, had, a long-standing friendship after that or something, because they seemed pretty close in that scene, that it made me wonder if they had met earlier afterwards as well, or, like, what brought them together for that scene.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was another strong scene in that you felt like you were getting a little bit closer to some sort of reality of Joe's life, and then also the life of another fighter that's been essentially just an image to both Joe and the viewer up until that point in the film. Right. Yeah, I think that maybe this movie fell down because the director perhaps just was a little too close to his subject in the end and wasn't willing to get a little critical distance and,
right.
And really wanted to force that happy ending in a sense. And it's interesting because it's, I don't, you know, I can't even imagine being a documentary filmmaker, like, and having to make all those decisions all the time about, like, both trying to collaborate with your subject, but at the same time, like, keep a certain amount of artistic awareness so that you kind of understand the project that you're making, is that would be extremely difficult. And this is one of the ones that didn't quite nail it, I think.
Yeah.
There maybe was a little bit too much deference to Joe in the end. All right, we got to move on to our final film, Whose Streets, which we just watched this evening by Sabah Foylan. This is a film that follows essentially everything that happened in the aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown by Darren Wilson in Ferguson in 2014, essentially positing that, you know, we've seen on the news the riots that took place after that, the vigils that took place after that. There's been discussions of the way in which the police force worked in the aftermath of the shooting and then in response to the riots or possibly inciting riots because of the militarization of the police in Ferguson, et cetera. This movie's trying to show all of those events from the side of the community that's actually there and living there and experiencing these things as very personal day-to-day realities, as opposed to kind of snippets on the news that so often paint a really skewed picture of what's actually going on. So I found it a very, certainly a powerful film, certainly emotional. Definitely brought up a lot of really just sad, awful feelings that we've probably all, many of us have had in the past few years of like watching one police officer after another not get indicted for shooting an unarmed, you know, black teenage boy. So did this, I guess my question for you, Spencer, is did this actually like change your perspective of the events or opinion of the events? Did it enlighten you, or was it more of an emotional shift in terms of how you thought about Ferguson and about what I think we would now just call like Black Lives Matter movements in general?
Yeah, I thought it was a really powerful emotional film, and I appreciate that it's sort of was just about the community sort of dealing with it and not so much about like trying to balance between like, oh, the community thinks this, but the policemen think this. And it's sort of like, it really kind of is like it felt very much like an open wound of like a movie. Like,
yeah.
And it's like separated into sort of five different parts. And there's sort of like different, there's like reoccurring people that appear throughout who all have sort of, like, different ways of participating in the demonstrations, but ultimately they're all collectively coming together for one cause. And I didn't necessarily, like, everything that was shown in the film is sort of already aligned with how I thought of the events that occurred. It's just sort of, like, it's a nice, I guess nice is not a good word to use in regards to this film, but it's like a crucial and necessary like time capsule of this particular moment in history that has since had such a reverberating effect on sort of how we view race in America and sort of how we deal with that. And then also sort of how generationally, like, this is, like, very different from the civil rights movement of, like, our parents and our grandparents. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of really nice to sort of have a film that situates the viewer in the lives of the community members in, like, their day-to-day lives and how they're processing grief. And sort of, it also interweaves a lot of, like, cell phone footage and sort of, like, people, like, on the ground level that, like, if you were to just watch these events happening on the news, you would get an entirely different perception of how these events went down. And it sort of also ties into, it also sort of calls into sort of, like, how social media has really impacted our, I guess, absorption of news and sort of how a lot of news sort of gets, I don't even know, like, misconstrued or, like, lost in the shuffle of sensationalism, basically. I don't know, like...
I feel like I can't imagine either of us were watching the events in Ferguson unfold and thinking, like, wow, I'm really upset that some people destroyed, you know, that gas station. Right. Except for, and like, right, so, okay, they destroyed property, like, that's nothing compared to killing children on the street. However, in this film, we get an opportunity to really feel the sense of the community watching everything lead up to that. So somehow it felt even more, like, imperative to just, like... The riots really in this movie feel like a direct result of these tanks coming down their street and the community feeling like we are being attacked. Like, yeah, we're being put under lockdown and we're under attack and we are living in a militarized zone right now and we increasingly have no way to, like, have our voice even heard. So you just feel that kind of desperation and that... so much and despair and, you know, coming out of these actions, so much more than even kind of intellectualizing.
Right. Yeah.
While you're watching the news. Yeah.
And there's also sort of, I really like that they also put in, like, town hall footage as well, right, which was something that I had never seen yet. Mm. And I'm sure it was out there. I just, like, hadn't stumbled upon it. And I thought those were also really interesting conversations because it's sort of like the community against sort of the people that ultimately decide the fate of the community and sort of this conflict between the two, and it becomes so evident and so clear that the people in the position of power are, like, not going to be doing anything, mm-hmm, to do it. This is, like, help, and it's just, like, it's such a helpless situation, and you really, it's just, like, you really feel that sort of among the people that just sort of are brave enough to go up to the mic and, like, literally tell the people, like, in their local governments, like, you're not helping. And, like, I don't know. Like, we literally don't know how to get out of this hole that you've built for us. And there's also sort of, like, in the Q&A, which I thought was incredible, sort of brought up sort of, like, this economic standpoint, too, of, like, we see... There's, like, a very sort of moving moment with a female African-American cop who sort of is, I mean, confronted essentially by a couple of community members as to sort of, like, hey, like, you're one of us, but you're also one of them. And how do you negotiate those two things? And it's, like, the cycle of you do have to, like, work and have a living and, like, feed yourself and, like, your family, but then you're also, in doing that, contributing then to the oppression of, like, a community that essentially you belong to, mm-hmm, even though you're still wearing the uniform as, like, an African-American. And so there's, like, a lot of really, like, complex sort of dynamics that arise that I found interesting as well.
Yeah. The film did make an effort to end on a more hopeful note, mostly built around the idea that this particular civil rights movement has spent a lot of time trying to educate the children, so that like children in these communities, children of color, know what they're fighting for and what their parents are fighting for so that they can be really educated about how to make a change in the world. I often, well, these days I keep bristling at sort of messages of hope. I feel like they almost feel demeaning in these kind of extremely dark times. Like, I don't really want to be reassured. But this movie, I think, did a, I think, a pretty nice job. Again, it's not a great word for this movie, but a fair job, I think, maybe earning a more hopeful ending simply because it didn't really put, you know, it wasn't really trying to put a bow on it. I think it was just representing the way in which this movement's been working. And so that's probably a legitimate way to end the movie with the children who will, in theory, take up the mantle moving forward.
Right. And sort of the resilience of the people currently, like, in the throes of it all.
Right, yeah. I mean, they ultimately still live there. So for them to just throw their hands up at the end of the movie and be like, nope, we're super hopeless, is, like, an odd thing. Because that's not what they're doing. Right, like, they're living every single day, and they're fighting every single day. And so, yeah, it felt earned and legitimate to me.
Same.
I feel like I just, since we only talked about three films, but we've each seen many films, I would want to plug a really good movie I saw, Love True, which you didn't get a chance to see, right?
I did not get a chance.
So I would plug Love True. Oh, and I guess we should say that The Cage Fighter and Whose Streets, I don't know their distribution.
Whose Streets is Magnolia. And then The Cage Fighter, I don't know if it has a distributor.
So Whose Streets will play in theaters, presumably, at some point moving forward. Okay. And I don't remember. I know that Shia LaBeouf produced Love True, oddly enough, but I don't actually know the, like, distribution plan for that. And I also got to see I Am Not Your Negro right before Whose Streets, which was, that film doesn't need me to say it was a good movie, but it was obviously a really great movie, so I would promote that too. Do you have another film that you would say is...
I would say Quest.
Oh, yeah.
Was, like, a really good movie. And it's sort of like, I saw it on the same day I saw Whose Streets, and there's sort of like themes that are sort of connected, and sort of like violence in communities, and sort of like how people in those communities cope with that, and sort of like there is sort of like a really, I mean, prevalent theme of like economic status and class that is intrinsically tied to race that is, I feel like, more like intimately explored in Quest than it is in Whose Streets. But it's like, I mean, understandably, because Quest is literally just about this one family,
mm-hmm.
whereas Whose Streets is about a community, which is like an entire community with many different voices. But yeah, I thought Quest was like extremely moving. And it was also really moving to see the family come out after the movie. That's what I love about True False, is that their subjects are, like, usually always at the screenings.
Yeah, True False is, I guess, we can plug the entire festival. It's great because it's a documentary film festival, the largest in America at this point. And I always thought it was the director was always at the screening, but sometimes they bend the rules where it'll be like a producer or an editor, but like somebody's always there to take questions from the audience afterwards, which with documentary feels like a more fruitful exercise than maybe sometimes with fiction filmmaking.
Right.
And a lot of times the subjects also come. So it's a really cool festival in that it builds a great community. All right. I think that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to Bijou Banter on the road in Columbia, Missouri, at the True False Film Festival. I'm, Spencer, thank you for talking to me.
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
And I'm Leah, and I look forward to more banter in the near future.
Awesome.
Oh my gosh. Do you think it worked?